This is David's Book Talk, bringing authors and book lovers together in a unique way since 2009. Visit us at davidsbooktalk.com and join the conversation at facebook.com/davidsbooktalk. But first, pull up a chair, relax, and enjoy today's episode. Here's your host, David English.
Hello and welcome to David's Book Talk, and today we have a very special guest. Her name is Sophie Hanna, and her new book, I think it's the seventh in the series, is called Kind of Cruel. She's the author of Wrong Mother. Hello, how are you?
Fine, thank you.
I always put the title of the last book you had out right on here. Wrong Mother was your book number six in the series?
No, book number six was called The Other Woman's House. Wrong Mother is number three in the series.
Oh, okay. This cover is so interesting, the fogginess. I love that. And there's something about that. Fog is such a wonderful thing for a book.
Yeah.
For the atmosphere of a book.
I love the cover, actually. The more I look at it, the more I like it.
You're an amazing writer. I've never read a book like this before. In that,
really?
Very complex, very psychological, very thoughtful. It makes you think an awful lot reading this book.
Right. Oh, good.
And and I never know how an author's going to take that when I say that. They usually take it very well, but sometimes they're very surprised or whatever. But how in the world do you come up with a book like this? I mean, it seems like it would be a lot of work.
I mean, obviously writing any book is a lot of work, but in terms of the ideas and the plot and the characters and all that, those are just the kind of ideas I have, and I think I would actually find it harder to come up with a linear thriller idea about a guy on the run from the CIA, you know? I mean, those just aren't the sorts of ideas I have. I tend to just naturally think in quite a sort of tangled relationships and dark psychological way. And so that's just how the ideas come to me, really.
Now, this is indeed book seven in the series?
It is, yep.
It is, because I know they come out in England before they come out here, which is a crime for us, but...
I think something's going to be done about that so that they come out more simultaneously at some point in the future. I know that my US publisher would like to you know, have simultaneous publication so that the books come out same time in the UK and the US.
Well, where are you more are you more popular over there or over here right now?
I think I'm certainly better known in the UK. So for example, in the UK my books always get into the top 10 of the book chart. So sort of the equivalent of the New York Times bestseller list, the Sunday Times bestseller list. I always get into the top 10, whereas I don't get into the New York Times top 10, although, you know, hopefully Kind of Cruel will. You never know.
Now, you've already written book number 8, right?
Yeah, and it's out in the UK. It's called The Carrier.
The Carrier. What is it about words that you seem to focus on words? Words that people have spoken. Is that a theme in a lot of your books?
Yes. I mean, I think of words as very important. I mean, I think words are almost as important as actions, really. I count words as actions, really.
I guess I was thinking more of what people say. I mean, it's this kind of rule. Not word, obviously, without words you wouldn't have a book, but people are thinking...
Often the clues and the mysteries in my books do involve some verbal or something about words written down. So, yeah, I think I do have a bit of an obsession with words. And also of the power of words to create mysteries, because, you know, we think of words as things which explain and elucidate and make things clearer, and normally they are, but words can also be used to mystify people and confuse people and mislead people. So, to me, words and the way they're used in a sort of ambiguous way or in a downright mysterious way is often quite a big part of my books.
Now, explain to people who haven't read your books the characters and what this one's about, the kind of cruel. There's a lot of mysteries in the book. It's not just one mystery.
There's a sort of main mystery, and then there are sort of little subsidiary mysteries, but actually all the smaller mysteries are part of the same big mystery, really. So when you find out what's going on, which of course I won't give away, you realise that they're all connected. The answers to all these questions are connected. So the main mystery involves Amber, who's the heroine. She's been suffering from chronic insomnia ever since her best friend Sharon was murdered in an arson attack. And Amber goes to see a hypnotherapist to try and cure her insomnia. And under hypnosis, she hears herself saying this strange combination of words that makes no sense to her. She hears herself saying the words kind, cruel, kind of cruel. And she has no idea why she said that or what those words mean. And then a couple of hours later, she's at home feeling confused about what happened and still wondering about those words. And a police detective turns up at her house and arrests her for the murder of a woman she's never heard of. And Amber quickly discovers that the reason this has happened is that the words kind, cruel, kind of cruel are the only clue that the police have found at the scene of a local unsolved murder. And Amber has no idea how the police could possibly know and know so quickly that she said those same words under hypnosis in a confidential therapy session. So that's really the main mystery. Amber has to try and work out what memory she has of those words, why those words are in her mind, just in case it links to this brutal unsolved murder, because if she can't work it out, she seems to be the only suspect, and she knows she didn't do it.
And so there is no, and there is no motive either.
Well, no, because she's never met this woman.
Right.
So she knows she didn't do it.
Well, she knows she's never met the woman. They don't know at that this
they
point.
They don't know. All they know is that she said the words that the murderer left at the scene of the crime. So, you know, it does look pretty suspicious.
Right, and there's something else that happens after her session, too, that you didn't mention, but maybe we don't want to
well,
give too much.
It's kind of quite hard because there's so much in the book. It's hard to introduce everything, so I try and sort of introduce the main mystery.
I'd love to see.
There's also a sort of subsidiary mystery which relates to something that happened in Amber's family 7 years earlier, which is that Amber's brother-in-law and his wife and children disappeared from a family Christmas gathering without leaving a message. They disappeared, you know, on Christmas Day. They left all their presents there. Nobody knew where they'd gone. And just as everyone's starting to get really worried, they reappeared but refused to tell anyone where they went and why. And Amber has never been able to forget about this. And that mystery, what happened to Neil and Joe and their sons that Christmas, where did they go, why did they come back, why won't they talk about it, that's also a sort of central part of the mystery of the book.
Well, you make it sound even better than it really is, and it's fantastic. And I love to hear you. I mean, authors have a good way of talking about their books, or they struggle with it, you know, because they don't give too much away. But I love the way you talk about your book. And there's also the mystery of who killed the woman in the fire too. That's also central to it.
Yes, so there are two murders. Yes, there's the murder of Amber's best friend Sharon in the fire, and then there's the murder of Catherine Allen, which is the one where the words "kind, cruel, kind of cruel" were found.
And it's all going to work itself out in the end, and I can't wait to get to the end. No, seriously, I'm not kidding. I'm really serious. I get so excited asking questions. I sometimes interrupt the author. I apologize for doing that. But when you love reading, you can't wait to ask the next question. You know, you can't wait to say, well, "What? I want to know why you wrote this book and what's going on and where it came from." And one wonders, you must have some kind of psychological background. I mean, were you a psychologist at one point?
No, I haven't had any formal psychological training at all. I've read lots of psychology books, and I've had sort of I'm 42, so I've had 42 years of experience of dealing with strange and crazy and dysfunctional people. I mean, we all deal with strange, crazy, dysfunctional people, but I've always been sort of attuned to that frequency. I've always noticed if people are behaving in a weird way. I've just always been really interested in people.
Right, which is central to life. I mean, and it's like when you go to the mall and you watch the way people act, and it is fascinating. You think, well, why is that person sitting there and just sitting there for hours? And what are they? Why are they doing this and that? It's totally fascinating.
Yeah.
Not to mention the guys that go to the mall to look at the pretty women. So, yeah, which we all know happens, but we never want to admit it, you know? Makes us look really bad. But your books are, I mean, this book is so complex, though. It just makes me think, how in the world did she write this book? It must have taken years to write this book. But you have a book that, you have a book like every year.
Yeah. Well, people say this to me quite a lot, that the books are very complex. I sort of can't really see that. I mean, I can see, in a way, you know, there's all the family relationships and a couple of murders, but I don't see them as being that... Well, no, I see them as being complex enough to be really interesting, hopefully, if I've done my job right, and a real challenge for the reader, because what I get sick of as a real passionate reader of crime fiction, I read so many crime novels where within 20 pages I've worked out the whole thing.
Oh, have you, really?
Yeah. No, I started, you know, it's happened to me a couple of times recently. I've started reading, you know, a big sort of much praised sort of crime debut, and within 20 pages I've got a theory about how it's all going to pan out. And so it's really disappointing if you can guess the solution to the mystery. So I just really try and write crime novels where hopefully people won't guess and will be desperate to find out what's going on. But then at the end, when they do find out what's going on, obviously it can't seem to have just come from nowhere, because that's cheating. So, you know, ideally I want the reader to be thinking, I didn't guess, but actually now I can sort of see there was that clue there and that clue there. So, I mean, I take the puzzle side of crime fiction really seriously. To me, that's a crucial part of any crime novel, the puzzle.
Well, what do you, when you, thinking about this book, and we can't go too much into detail about the solution, but I'm curious, did you think of the puzzle first or the solution first? I mean, do you, when you know the whole answer right now, and I don't, but I'm wondering which you thought of first.
I thought of two different things first. So I thought of the initial puzzle of somebody saying these words, kind of cruel, before I even knew what those words meant. I knew that I liked the idea of someone saying them in the middle of a sort of hypnosis session and not knowing what they mean.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, I also thought of the motive for murder. So I had an ending, I had a mysterious beginning, and I sort of worked inwards from both ends, if that makes sense.
Interesting. Yeah, I mean, it's such a great. I mean, it's one of these books, and I was up late last night reading it. I didn't get much sleep last night, thanks to you. I just wanted you to know that. Because and I'm texting a friend of mine who is a more voracious reader than I. We always go back and forth on books. She's actually going to purchase the book today, just to, based on what I said to her. You know, because she said she loves psychological stuff. In fact, her son has something to do with psychology, so. He can probably help you out with some of your books, actually. I'll have to put you in touch.
Definitely.
But, you know, psychology is such a wonderful, wonderful thing. I mean, you got a blurb here from Laura Lippman, I see, and Laura, she calls you a prodigious talent. I mean, what a wonderful thing to say about an author.
Well, I mean, that was a huge... honour to have that quote. I mean, Laura Lippman is one of my very, very favourite crime writers. She'd probably be in my top five crime writers.
Have you ever met her?
Yes, I've met her twice. I met her at BoucherCon once, and I did a panel event with her once for a libraries convention. I mean, obviously it's lovely when anyone really likes your book, but to have praise like that from her was just amazing.
I don't know how you feel, but the first time I met her, she's one of those people that you wish you could go out and have lunch with.
Yeah.
Immediately.
She's really interesting as well. She gave a really interesting talk at this libraries convention panel that we did.
I mean, she's so sweet, and then she comes out with these really interesting things that she says, and it's like, wow, what an interesting woman. You know, being married to the guy who created The Wire, and it's like, oh, my God, how wonderful must that be for you? The Wire being, you know, many people consider it one of the best shows ever, but... Yeah, definitely.
I think it's got a strong claim to be one of the best shows ever. Definitely.
Now, are your books always over 400 pages?
Little Faith, the first one, wasn't. And since then, I mean, some are and some aren't, but usually they're between sort of 400 and 450 pages. Yeah.
Right, which is a long book. That's considered a long book.
I keep trying to have shorter ideas, but it hasn't seemed to work.
How is it that the flow of ideas keep coming to you? And these books are very complex. It's not like you can just sit and write them. There's a lot of thought that has to go into this.
I never have a problem with having ideas. I've always got a backlog of ideas that I'm keen to write. It's just, you know, the pressure of doing one a year, that's quite tough. I mean, in an ideal world, crime writers would produce a novel every 2 years, and that would be fine. And I mean, I could do that if I wanted to, but there's sort of an expectation that if you're writing commercial genre fiction and if you're a bestseller, then you will write one a year.
Right, and if they're this good, you know, good God, I mean, who's going to complain, you know?
they're all slightly different from each other. And I mean, the funny thing for me is because, you know, The Carrier, the one that's just come out in the UK, is my eighth, and every single book that comes out, every time I have a new book out, some people say, oh, this is the best one yet after the disappointing last one. And some people say, this one's very disappointing after the last one, which was the best one yet. And so you just never have any idea.
Does that bother you when people say that?
Well, no, because for each book, right since the first one, there have been some people saying this is fantastic and some people saying this is awful. And you just can't get any kind of consensus, really. So I just keep on writing the books I want to write. But I think, you know, because my books are quite dark, they're quite psychologically analytical, and I think a lot of people just don't want to work that hard if it's a thriller. So if it was given to them as a literary novel, then they might sort of think, okay, I have to pay attention here and, you know, use my brain, and that's okay. But if they're reading a thriller, they expect it to be more of an easy read, possibly.
More like a James Patterson.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. So probably James Patterson's most devoted fans would probably not like my books because my books would require them to maybe just to sort of work a bit too hard or maybe just they're, you know, they go into slightly more detail about all the relationships and the psychological stuff and they're not sort of, you know, a dead body or a sort of explosion every few pages. Thriller readers who want that.
Well, the problem with James Patterson, and this is in my mind, I couldn't speak for everybody, but I don't like his endings anymore. I've gotten to the point where I'm disgusted by his endings, and that's just a feeling that they don't satisfy me enough. It's like eating half of a candy bar, you know. To me, I just don't like the endings. It's so important to have a great ending. I mean, it is absolutely vital to the book, and that's what people say online. If they don't like the ending, they're going to say that, and it ruins the book for them.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's not like these crime shows that they show in the U.S. anymore, that where they halfway through the show they've accused one guy, and you know it's not going to be him because there's another 30 minutes left of the show. What are they going to do? You know?
Exactly. And actually, that's what I mean when I say, you know, I want to write books which are sort of challenging for fans of crime fiction, because there are certain patterns that we're all used to, like the person who they say it is three quarters of the way through is obviously not going to turn out to be the killer. And so what I try to do, I mean, I'm very keen on sticking to all the rules of crime fiction. So I always give a solution to the mystery. I try not to break any of the rules of the genre, but within those rules, I try to be as original as I can. Because I want to write something that's going to satisfy people who love the crime genre, but that's also going to make them think, wow, this is actually really different. So that's what I'm trying to do.
Now, right in the middle of the book, there's a scene between Joe and Amber, which is so electric. I love that scene where they're standing in the kitchen and all of a sudden they just have this argument, this really brutal argument. And I love this. I love that these characters are so... They get on each other's nerves, and I'm thinking, she's doing this right in the middle of a get together, and you don't make your guests angry while you're having them over, you know. And it's like, it's so interesting the way you do that, and the dialogue, your dialogue is spectacular. I mean, it's back and forth, but it's an intelligent dialogue. It's not like a lot of these other books that I just can't read, you know. But I love the way you do that.
thank you.
Is that?
Well, I mean, you know, that's what the kind of thing that wouldn't happen in a lot of crime novels. You know, it wouldn't happen in a James Patterson or, a lot of other crime novels. But because Kind of Cruel, the mystery is all about the relationships between the characters and the psychology of the characters. So really, to solve the puzzle of the plot, you have to first solve the puzzles of the individual people and how they relate to each other. So that conversation between Amber and Joe, where they have an argument in the kitchen, it looks as though it's just, you know, not part of the murder plot, but it absolutely is. Everything is a clue. Every interaction that one character has with another is part of the sequence of clues.
And I'm getting a feeling, and I don't know this for sure, but I'm getting a feeling Neil's kind of like a doorstop. You know, whatever Joe wants, Joe gets, you know, sort of. And, you know.
Yeah, I'm trying to work. I can't remember whether you've got to the bit. Have you got to the bit where Amber confronts Neil in the street and says, "Where did you go?"
Yes, I did.
Yeah, okay, so we won't give anything away, but, you know, that was one of my favorite bits of the plot. His answer to that question.
I mean, Amber's got a lot of anger. I mean, you can see it coming out in different parts of this book. She's got a lot of anger and a lot of frustration for not knowing what's going on. And she's like us.
Yes, and also she hasn't slept properly for 18 months, which is what I say, because some people like the fact that she's quite stroppy and sarcastic and, you know, a bit of a character. But some people say, oh, you know, she's so harsh and sarcastic, to which I always say, how do you think you would be if you hadn't slept for 18 months? Do you think you'd be lovely and in a good mood and charming to everyone you meet?
One wonders how she even functions if she's not sleeping.
Well, she sleeps. She sleeps sort of. I did a bit of research into insomnia and you know, sleep patterns. And, you know, it's not like she doesn't sleep at all,
right,
but she just doesn't sleep in a sort of continuous way through the night. So she'll sort of snatch an hour here and there. But it's not proper, you know, nourishing sleep.
People think I'm crazy, but the way I get myself to sleep is I talk. I talk to myself, and it always puts me to sleep.
Really?
Yeah, and I don't know why, but it always does. I always am able to sleep when I talk.
Oh, that's interesting.
And people think, oh, this guy's nuts. Why, who would do that? You know, nobody's going to, you know. Well, I mean, there's the counting sheep kind of thing. Everybody says, well, if you count sheep, by the time you get back to one, you're asleep. But
yeah.
If that always worked, boy, I'd do it every night. But maybe I'll have to try that sometime to see if it works. But it really works when I start talking. I'll talk about something that happened during the day or something I've seen on TV, and just before I know it, I'm asleep.
Yeah.
I guess you think people say, well, why don't you read? Reading will put you to sleep. But
yeah.
Not reading your books, though, that's for sure. But I mean, not being able to sleep, I've been through that. I know what that's like. It's a horrible, horrible thing. And I had, I not only had not being able to sleep, I had depression on top of it.
Oh, so, yeah. Well, no, that sounds, yeah.
And a major.
Well, they're often linked, aren't they?
Yeah, I guess they really are. I guess at the time I didn't realize they were. I was reading something by David Foster Wallace, who wrote Infinite Jest. And
he suffered from depression, didn't he?
Really horrible, horrible, to the point where he hanged himself.
Okay.
Yeah, and there's a thing with People magazine talking about how he's talking about how you have to control your thoughts. And to really be able to control your thoughts, if you can't, you'll never be able to survive. And I found that fascinating to read about that. I think to myself, that, you know, that's really true. I mean, we worry about what people say about us and all these different things. And, you know, we shouldn't worry about things like that. All those worries should be gone, you know. You move on to the next thing.
Yeah.
And your book's making me think about that, too. This book, Kind of Cruel, makes me think about, you know, what I say to other people and the impact it has and what I should, how honest I should be.
Right. Oh, that's interesting.
Are you an honest person? Are you one of those people who just always has to speak honestly?
No. So I'm in fact, I've written a blog post about this recently, about my heroines being stroppy and assertive. And I said in this blog post that the reason they are is because I'm the opposite. So I will always say the necessary thing to smooth things over. I always try and make the other person feel okay, you know, so often this results in, you know, if people are being rude or obnoxious to me or treating me badly, I'll just sort of put up with it and smooth it over and try, you know, sort of think, oh, well, as long as they're feeling okay, it doesn't matter how they're making me feel. So that's my natural tendency, but I know that this is not good and not healthy, and I've got a lot of repressed anger probably because of it, and I think this is why my heroines are always stroppy and constantly yelling at people, because I haven't yelled at people enough in my life, so they do it for me. But in terms of honesty, I would say I'm always very honest with myself. So I'm not, you know, there are some people who, if they do something wrong, because they can't bear the thought that they've done something wrong, they have to lie to themselves so that they're the good guy, and right. The person they did the wrong thing to is somehow the bad guy. Whereas if I do something wrong, I know I'm doing something wrong. So I might lie to other people for strategic reasons, but I don't think I lie very much to myself.
Hmm. That's fascinating. I mean,
and in fact, that's one of the, in terms of characterization, that's one of the themes of all my books, because I think it's one of the crucial differences between people. The people who would never lie to anybody else, but lie to themselves constantly. So they believe lying is wrong, so they wouldn't lie to other people. But they kind of do without realizing it, because their version of the truth is so distorted. And then there are other people. A classic fictional example is Greg House in the medical drama House.
Oh, yeah.
He doesn't lie to himself. He knows he's capable of acting like a complete git, but he lies to other people when he needs to, and he knows he's doing it.
Maybe that's why I never liked the show, because I don't like that. I guess... Not them.
You don't like House?
Oh, no, I don't like House at all. I watched the first show, I couldn't watch anymore. I couldn't stand the way he treated other people. I guess that bothered me to the point where I couldn't watch the show.
Oh, that's interesting. It's my favorite TV show of all time.
He's so nasty to people, though. He's like a Dr. Phil, you know? He's terrible. Even though...
He is nasty to people, but only on the surface, deep down... He's actually nice to them. That's my theory. So he's a real pain in the ass, as you would say.
But he offends so many people, though.
And he offends people, but by what I think he does is he bees the bad guy in order that they can all sort of hone their own moral sensibilities on him. So he sacrifices his chance to look like a good guy and be perceived as a good guy by being kind of over-the-top bad. And by doing that, he enables all of the people around him to grow as people. So I think he's actually, in a subtle way, quite heroic.
It's one of the fascinating things about that show. When I watched the first show, I did like it a lot, but I never went back and watched it again. There must have been something that was bothering me that I didn't even realize. But I know it's a very, very popular show, or it was when it was on, and it's still in reruns, I'm sure, somewhere, but... There's something about the characters in TV shows. If I really can't relate to the characters, I can't watch the show. And
yeah, I agree. But I can relate to all of them. I can relate to House. I can relate to Wilson, who is the put upon best friend. I can relate to all the staff who have to kind of put up with House. And of course, the other thing is he's saving lives every day. Mm. So you know, if you buy into the creation of the show. Yes, he is an obnoxious git a lot of the time, and he breaks every rule there is, but he's an amazing, brilliant genius, and he saves the life of every patient he has. So it's kind of like, you know, maybe it's worth it to have the good he does and put up with the negative side.
Exactly. Now, have all your books been out from Putnam? Have all seven in the series available from Putnam right now?
No, the others are all published by Penguin, which is, it's the same publisher, effectively.
Right.
But this was my first hardcover, and so they decided to do it with Putnam, because Putnam do a lot of crime hardcovers.
Oh, really? So none of them... Oh, interesting. So this is something new for you. This is your first book with Putnam, actually, with that imprint.
Yeah.
An imprinter. I mean, now Penguin and Random House are together. Who would have ever thought that was going to happen? But, you know, the world is changing at such a fast pace.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, you're writing book 9 now?
Yes. So I've finished the first draft, and I'm just about to start doing the edits.
Wow. Can you tell us the title at all?
Yeah, it's called The Telling Error.
The Telling Era. Oh, yeah, I think I did see something about that online. It's fascinating what you can find online about upcoming books.
Yeah.
There's a great site called fantasticfiction.com, which is just tremendous in telling.
Oh, yes, I think I know it, yeah.
I've been there so many million times, I can't even tell you. I'm finding out who... I want to know what book's coming out next, and I always want to know the next book. As a reader, as a voracious reader, you always want to know what the author's working on next. You know, you can't help but ask.
Yeah. And, well, no, that's what I'm working on, The Telling Era.
But
hopefully...
Tell me some of the... Tell me some of the characters in the police in this book. There's Sam and Simon. Explain. Tell me a little bit about each one. I want you to go through them because I get confused with some of them. There's so many characters in the police department, and I get confused as to who is who.
Well, the main ones are Simon Waterhouse and Charlie Zahler. Charlie's a woman. And Simon and Charlie are married. They're the sort of main central detective characters. Simon is the brilliant genius detective who solves every mystery. I really wanted, when I started writing crime fiction, to have something that I think has become unfashionable in crime fiction. You know, it used to happen all the time where there was the detective who was just so intellectually brilliant that he could solve every case. That doesn't seem to happen so much anymore. Or at least the detective generally does solve every case, but it's not kind of foregrounded. It's almost like he just happens to solve every case. Whereas I wanted to have a detective like Sherlock Holmes or Hercule Poirot or Miss Marple, who everyone kind of says, wow, that guy's a genius, he solves every case. So that's Simon. Charlie is his long-suffering wife. They're basically happily married, but he has issues around sex and intimacy and sort of relationships, basically. He's got various psychological hang-ups. So they're an item. And Charlie is also a police officer, but she's not a detective. She works in a different branch of the police, but she always ends up getting dragged into Simon's cases. And then there are sort of subsidiary characters around the edges. There's Giles Proust, who is Simon and Charlie's horrendously insulting and difficult boss.
I hate him. I really hate that man. I think if I met him on the street, I think I'd slap him.
Yeah, he's not a nice character. But I quite enjoy writing his lines.
I bet you do.
He's so horrible that it makes him quite good fun to write.
He's even worse than that woman on Inspector Lewis, the head person on it. I don't know if you've ever seen Inspector Lewis. The
boss,
woman who,
yeah.
She's kind of a nasty, that woman too, I want to slap her too. It's like, it's just her attitude. But anyway, continue.
So then there's Sam Combasecra, who is Simon's immediate sort of superior officer. He's the sergeant, and he's a nice character. He's sort of the most normal, well-adjusted, sane one of all the detectives.
Where did you come up with a last name like that?
Combasecra. Well, when I invented that name, I must admit, I thought he would only be in that one book, which was my second crime novel, The Truth Teller's Lie. And then I decided to keep him and make him into a regular character. And everyone says, well, loads of readers say, I can't pronounce his surname. Is it okay if I just call him Sam K?
Yes.
I always say, yes, that's fine.
As long as you read my book, you can call him anything you want.
Yeah, exactly.
And then we have Gibbs.
Gibbs is a sort of surly, not very communicative detective who works with Simon and who, crucially for the plot, is having an affair with Charlie's sister, Olivia. And that sort of started off in the previous book, the other woman's house.
Mm-hmm.
And Charlie was at first very upset that her sister has kind of muscled in on her professional life by having an affair with effectively one of her colleagues.
It's interesting because this is book 7, and I have to admit I had not read any of your other books. Of course, now I want to more than anything. But is it necessary for somebody to start at the beginning? Do you think it's better if they start at the beginning of your series?
I don't, actually. I never read series books in the right order, and I don't think it matters at all if people read them.
Except for maybe background information about the characters that we don't know.
Well, the way I see it is it's like meeting people in real life. You know, you meet them at a certain point in their story.
Right.
And, you know, if you're interested, you find out more about what happened to them before that point, and if you're not interested, then then you don't have to.
Right. And I'm glad you said that, because there's six books before, and if I had to read six before I had to go back to this one, I think I'd go nuts. You know, it's like, it'd be a long time before I got back to this book, and I wouldn't like that. And that, you know, the idea of having to read six books in the series beforehand is kind of daunting, especially in this crazy world we live in right now.
Yeah, I mean, this is why the books, if you look at the packaging of the books, it doesn't say a Simon Waterhouse mystery, you know, or Simon Waterhouse mystery number 7, because the publishers and I have always felt that the books are more standalones than they are series, even though the detectives with their ongoing storyline are a big part of the books. Effectively, each book belongs to the protagonist of that particular book.
I want to see Kirsty solve a mystery one time.
I'm not sure that would be possible. It was interesting actually writing a character who couldn't speak, you know.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And you're right, and Kirsty's an interesting part of it, and how the others relate to her. I mean, how, you know, it's very hard to take care of somebody like that. How old is she in the books?
She's an adult. She's probably in her 30s.
Right. I had a friend who had a daughter who was very difficult. Now, when I would go over to her house, she would, like, scream, you know, and she wouldn't be able to control herself at some point. And my friend would spend a lot of time just trying to calm her down. And she finally had to put her, you know, somewhere where they could take better care of her, because she would sometimes hurt herself. And it was very difficult. And all I could think of was, wow, Joanne, you've got so much on your plate already, and I don't know how you do everything. And still be one of the nicest people I've ever met. It still remains that way to this day. But all that pressure that she had on her now is not there anymore, because her daughter has been put in a place where they can really watch her and really take care of her. And all that is off of her now, and it's a humongous responsibility. I mean, and yet, it's what you do as a mother, and you would never do it any other way, but boy, the pressure that puts on a person, and to have a full-time job and a husband and all that on top of it.
Well, I mean, that's a crucial part of the book, really, the whole, you know, how does it affect the family to have, you know, somebody who needs that kind of care.
I know people that could help you out with your books, I think.
Sounds like it.
I can put you in touch with Joanne. She can tell you all about it, you know, in great detail. It can help you out. But I think it's interesting the way you introduce those characters. And Joe, of course, who's totally sympathetic to everybody and every situation. And then there's Amber, who's, you know, well, to be quite realistic, you know, I wouldn't want to have to take care of her. And Quentin. What's up with Quentin, too?
Yes. Oh, well, you know, you're asking all the right questions, because all of this is very relevant to the plot. Quentin basically is one of those elderly men who, the minute his wife died, he's incapable of... I mean, he obviously could learn to look after himself, but he's never going to. And so Joe has taken him in. So Joe is really responsible for him and her own children, and, you know, her mother and her sister are there all the time, and she's got this slightly useless, feckless brother who doesn't seem to be able to look after himself entirely. So Joe is really almost a sort of a mother figure to everybody.
Hmm. You make it sound like Quentin could be a clue to the answer to the puzzle. That's interesting. I didn't think of him that way. But I'm not giving away too much, because these are characters in the books. But
He's not. Well, I don't want to give too much away. But certainly, you know, Quentin is there for a reason, like everything else in the book. So
you mean even Kirsty's there for a reason?
Oh yeah. No, I mean, nobody's there. I mean, with a crime novel, you know, if there's a group of people living in a house, and, you know, one of them's an elderly dependent relative, and one of them's, you know, I don't know what the politically correct term is for what Kirsty is, but she has the mental age of a very young child. You know, all of that is not there by coincidence. It's all there for a reason.
How interesting. I didn't realize that until you just said that, and then completely...
You'll see what I mean when you get to the end.
God, now I can't wait to get to the end. You're driving me crazy. Which is, I guess, is the point, to get people interested in the books. And these books are so fascinating. I mean, just this one alone, if this is anything like the other... Is this book... Are the other books very similar to this? in the mysterious aspects of them?
Yes, they're similar. I mean, they're all completely different in terms of the actual plot. So, for example, one of them starts with a man confessing to the murder of someone who isn't dead. And one of them starts with a woman looking on a property website, and in the photographs of a house that's for sale, she sees a dead body lying face down in a huge pool of blood.
Oh, my
gosh. You know, they all start with very different things, and they're about very different themes. But in terms of the kinds of mysteries and the, I suppose, the... lots of people tell me that my crime novels are very, very different from everybody else's crime novels. So I guess the fact that I have a strange and eccentric imagination would give all my books a similar flavour, even if the subject matter is quite different.
Well, I guess if to be considered strange, it depends on who's saying it. Some people would think you were normal, and some people would think you were strange. It's like, what's strange anymore? I mean, there was a time I thought a transsexual was strange, but anymore now, I think they're almost kind of normal.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess it's, and we all think of that. It's weird. I mean, it's like, well, what's normal anymore? I mean, who can even say what's normal anymore? But just having you describe those other books makes me want to read them immediately. I mean, what a fascinating thing. I wonder what your IQ is. Do you know what your IQ is?
No, I have no idea.
Because the way you come up with these plots, and these books, they've got to be difficult to write. I mean, maybe they're easier for you, but just hearing about them, I think, how in the world do you come up with plots like this? And the intricacies are what fascinate me. I mean, they're very intricate books. They're not books you can just sit down and say, well, this is this, and this. It all has to make perfect sense, which has got to require weeks of thought.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of sort of logistical planning that goes into the structuring of the plot. I mean, one of the things that I'm most interested in is plot architecture, you know, so the plot, everything has to weave into everything else in a sort of structurally satisfying way. But in terms of it being difficult, it's honestly, these are the ideas that come to me, and in that sense it's easier for me to write these books. You know, if you said to me, write a book that's a bit like Linwood Barclay, for example.
Oh, I like him, yeah.
Yeah, I really like Linwood Barclay. He's one of my favourite crime writers. But I could no more have a Linwood Barclay-ish idea than I could fly to the moon, because it's just not my... that's just not the way my imagination works. So I think, in a way, any writer makes life easier for themselves by writing the ideas that are sort of them-ish ideas, the ideas that come to them naturally and that they're interested in.
Hmm. Why? And the guy that confesses to a murder that hasn't even been committed yet. What a fascinating idea that is.
Yeah. Well, that was in terms of the plot, that was probably my most ambitious novel so far.
Now, what one's that? What is that called?
It's called The Dead Lie Down.
The Dead. I think I have that somewhere. I think I've gotten that. I'm on some kind of list, and they send me all these your books.
Oh, right. Yeah, well, then you may well have.
And you're one of those authors that I wanted to read, and I'm now wondering, why didn't I read her before? You know? That sounds very cliche, isn't it? I think, well, he's only saying that because he's interviewing, but I really mean that, because I look at authors, and I've heard really great things about you, but this, I had no idea how great they really were. I mean, just from the indication of this book, I can't. The way the world is, once you find an author you really trust and really, you really know that you're going to get a good book every time. Unless I have to admit, there's a Sue Grafton book that I didn't like as much as her other ones. There's one book, I won't tell you what it is, it's be pointless really, but it does happen occasionally where an author will write a book and you just don't like that book, and hopefully it doesn't turn you off to the author completely, but every author can write a bad book, it can happen.
Yeah, absolutely.
In your mind, did you ever write a bad book?
I just think it's impossible to be objective about your own books.
Well, there must have been one. There's always one that the author will tell me they don't like as much, or maybe they were learning, and you know, and you don't feel that way, though.
Well, I published three books before I started writing crime, but even those I thought were, in their way, they were okay. They weren't as sort of mature as my crime novels. I mean, with each book, there are sort of anxieties that I have about them and things that I like about them, but I can't really be sort of objectively judgmental about them because I, you know, I'm just too close to them. It's like looking at the inside of my own head. So I just don't know. I know, you know, the ones that I'm more attached to rather than less attached to. Yeah.
So is that, it's interesting.
But, I mean, obviously I feel that they're all good or else I wouldn't, you know, if I'd written something I thought it was a bad book, I wouldn't let it be published.
Right, but think your first book, say the first book in this series, I don't know the name of it.
Yeah, Little Face, yeah.
Do you think that you were learning at that point and that you didn't fully have down everything you needed to have down, or do you think you were really good right from the beginning?
I think I certainly needed a lot of editing, but then I still do. I mean, you know, with every book, I hand in the first draft, and my editor goes, there are some things wrong with it.
Right.
And I go, oh, no, and then I sort them out. So, yeah, in some ways, I think I am, you know, learning and becoming a better writer. But in other ways, in a way, it gets harder with each book because you've already written so many, and each one, you know, in order for me to sort of feel passionately about the book I'm writing, it has to feel like a step forward and different enough and exciting enough. And
well, were they I think
somehow it feels, and also I get more ambitious with each book, so somehow it feels as though it gets harder rather than easier.
What's that term that the writers use, sophomore slump? Like the second book's always the bad one. Like the first book, if the first book is really great, the second one's going to be a bad one. And have you ever heard that term before?
Yeah, it's the difficult second album syndrome. I have to admit that very much didn't happen to me. My second book was the easiest one to write of all of them, and it is the book that a lot of people say they think is my best. Oddly enough, it's the one that has sold fewest copies in the UK anyway.
The Truth Teller, is that the Truth Teller's Lie?
Truth Teller's Lie, yes. Of all my books that was published, that have been published in the UK, it's the one that sold least well. That could be because it's quite dark. It's about rape, so maybe some people are put off by the subject matter. But lots of people have said that's my best book. And it was certainly easiest to write. And I think the reason is that I wrote it just after I'd found out that the first book, Little Face, had been accepted for publication. And I was on a high. You know, it was the first kind of validation that I'd had as a crime writer. Suddenly, instead of just being someone writing away with no idea whether anyone would be interested, suddenly I had a publisher who wanted me to write another crime novel, and I had a two-book contract. So I felt sort of that people believed in my abilities as a crime writer, which I hadn't felt before. So, the second one was the easiest to write for me.
I want to read your next book. I don't think I'm going to be able to wait a year to read that. What's it called, The Carrier?
The Carrier, yeah. Well, you've got all the others that you can read in the meantime.
That's right. I don't know that I can wait. I'm going to go crazy waiting, you know. Especially when I know it's already out overseas and I can't get it, you know.
Yeah. I believe you can order it from certain independent bookshops in America. It is possible to get the English edition.
I'll have to look into that for sure. What do you do to get away from all this? I mean, do you have hobbies? Do you have other things you can do? Or are you totally surrounded by writing?
I swim a lot. I swim every day, and that's a good way of getting away from writing and, you know.
But I'm sure you think about writing when you're swimming, too.
I do, but not in a kind of stressy, focused way. And often when I'm swimming and just my mind is relaxed, that's when I have some of my best ideas.
If you think about ideas, and ideas, I mean, it's easy to have an idea, but to write a book, and to write a book is as well-written as Kind of Cruel is, it's got to be difficult. That's what I could never understand, how you do it. I mean, how is writing the first word difficult?
Yes, there's a lot of pressure on the first sentence.
And so how do you get over that? How do you get through that?
I just tell myself, it doesn't have to be perfect first time. If I just get started and just write something down, and then I can go back to it and perfect it later on.
Is there anything you can tell? Now, you say there's always something you need to change when you turned in the first draft of Kind of Cruel. Was there anything specific that you had to change that you can tell us about without giving away any of the plot?
Anything I had to change about Kind of Cruel? I'm trying to remember because I edited that book a couple of years ago, so I can't remember what.
Right. I'm just curious. I'm just curious what kind of things you have trouble with and what you need to perfect. when after you write your first draft?
Well, I mean, it's different in every... So, for example, the book I'm editing now, my editor said that the heroine's story got a bit lost in some other more subplotty story, so I need to bring out the main storyline and the heroine's... The heroine needs to kind of take up more space, and the minor characters need to take up less space. In my latest book, The Carrier, that's just come out in the UK, I remember my editor said that the romantic hero, it wasn't clear what was so great about him and why anyone would fall in love with him, so I had to sort of beef him up a bit to make him lovable.
That's funny. Beef him up a little bit. Make him more beefcakey, you know?
No, not physically, just his character.
Oh, his character.
So, yeah, it's a different thing with every book, really.
That's great. I just wanted to get an example of what you have trouble with. As readers, we like to know, you know, what was the book like before I saw it, you know, and what, as opposed to what way it is now. I'd love someday to see the before and after of a story. I mean, what it started out as and what it transformed into. It's something fascinating. It's like watching this behind the scenes of movies. You know, it's always fascinating to see how they make these scenes seem so real,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
I watched a scene on, I don't know if you have ever seen True Blood, that vampire series that's on now.
No, I've never seen it.
There was a scene, I think it was on a week ago last Sunday, with a woman who kills another woman with a high heel. And I will never forget that scene as long as I live. It was one of the most graphic scenes I've ever seen on TV. And she kills her through a grate in the bottom of this walkway. And it's just,
yeah.
It is the most horrible scene I think I've ever seen in this show. And it's going to stay with me for the rest of my life now because it's so graphic. But, you know,
yeah.
It's fascinating. I think about something like, how did they do that? And her face is all bloody and you're thinking, boy, they make it look so real. And today is amazing what they can do.
Yeah, no, it's...
But what you do as a writer, good God, I don't even know how you do it. And yet you these books are so wonderful and fascinating. This has just been a fascinating conversation with you.
Thank you. Well, yeah, no, it's been really, really interesting, yeah.
I love reading your books. I really, truly love reading. Someday I'll get a signed copy from you.
Yeah. Where are you based?
I'm in Pennsylvania.
Right, okay.
Yeah.
Well, they do sometimes send me there on my American tours, so...
I look forward to talking to you again. We've been talking about Kind of Cruel. It's out, just out for Putnam. We have to say goodbye. I don't even want to say goodbye. I love talking to you.
Yeah, no, it's been really great chatting to you.
And
I really hope you enjoy the rest of the book.
I know I'm going to enjoy it. I can't wait to get back and reading it. I may have to skip work today. But this has been Dave's Book Talk, and we will talk to you next time.
You have just enjoyed the podcast of David's Book Talk, brought to you by your host, book lover David English. Please visit us at davidsbooktalk.com, follow us on Facebook and Twitter, and subscribe to our podcast. We want to hear from you, and we don't want you to miss our upcoming shows with top authors like Mary Higgins Clark, Patricia Cornwell, Lisa Scottolini, Jackie Collins, Nelson DeMille, Michael Connelly, Sue Grafton, Steve Martini, Dale Brown, David Baldacci.